This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program today, we're going to talk about something our guest calls sour charm wisdom. It is what historian, philosopher, and poet Jennifer Michael Hecht says is the path to happiness. Hecht argues in her new book, The Happiness Myth, what we think is right is wrong, a history of what really makes us happy, that our basic assumptions about how to be happy are nonsense. So what is sour charm? Hecht describes it this way, a kind of cheerful world weariness, not the sad and tender feeling of bittersweet, but a wry, disappointed geniality. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. I look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Jennifer Michael Hecht earned her Ph.D. in history from Columbia University. She teaches at the New School. She is the author of Doubt, A History, and The End of the Soul. The latter book won the Phi Beta Kappa Society's 2004 Ralph Waldo Emerson Award. Her award-winning books of poetry include The Next Ancient World and Funny. The new book, Happiness, The Happiness Myth, is published by Harper San Francisco, and you can find our guest on the web at www.jennifermichaelhecht.com. Again, questions, comments, they are welcome. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
I feel like planning a party and having chocolate cake.
Yes. You've been reading my book.
I have.
I advise chocolate cake. Yeah. I'm finding that it's sort of helpful to start talking about my book by saying it's not what people quite imagine a happiness book is going to be about. I think we all have some basic ideas about what to do in order to be happy, and most of the books have different takes on that overall idea, and I guess mine is sort of going in the opposite direction. I've been a historian for a long time now, and especially my book Doubt, A History had me reading about, it's about religious doubt all over the world throughout history, so I learned a lot of different cultures and a lot of different time periods, and I came back to our 21st century thinking that we were making ourselves crazy about a lot of nonsense. I know that sounds strong, but when I look at Fletcherizing, which was the idea that the 19th century idea, you should chew your food at least 32 times each bite, and people really, I mean, this lasted for decades. There are etiquette books on how to have a dinner party half the people are chewers and half the people aren't. There were important figures in American culture who were dedicated Fletcherizers and who said that chewing made them happy and healthy. And it went on for decades, and people who didn't chew felt guilty, and people who were chewers but didn't chew every single mouthful of the mouth, and they drove themselves crazy. And the Victorians, because of their concern about sex, put skirts around their pianos so you wouldn't see the legs. And they made themselves crazy. And I think we're doing the same thing with our interest in diet and exercise and the body beautiful, and a couple other big points that we have kind of backwards.
Yeah, I want to thank you for helping us cheer up a bit here.
Yeah.
with this book, which is what you say at the end is your goal, one of your goals. Why is it that we embrace an idea like Fletcherizing, or, you know, why do we embrace the ideas we do about happiness?
Yeah, well, some of them, to find out the precise reason for each given thing, you have to look pretty closely at the historical situation. But overall, you can look across history and say, there doesn't seem to be any consensus about what you should eat and how you're going to feel. there's just a tremendous amount, or how much you should have sex and how you're going to feel, or how, you know, there's very little consensus about even medical things. What there is consensus is about that we like to go on fads. We like to dedicate ourselves to these kinds of ideas that we think of as lifelong when we buy into them, but they are almost never lifelong. Most people enjoy doing these things for short stints, and they report feeling better. I myself have tried such things and reported feeling better for a while. Well, why don't you keep doing it forever? Because I don't think it's any of the specifics. I think it's being dedicated to a certain rule, and that means knowing what you're supposed to do and what you're not supposed to do, and for a short period of time, that does make us happy. So it's not entirely that you shouldn't do these things, but that you should do it with the kind of perspective that you get from either traveling or traveling in history, looking around at other cultures and seeing what stays the same and what changes.
Yeah. It seems to me a little bit today that we're scolded into the good life.
Yeah, absolutely. What's going on for us in America is that our economy is based on us all going home and baking cookies and then coming out to the market square and having our bake sale. And we all have to seduce each other into coming and buying our product. And so it's no surprise that our economic world is one of constant indulgence, talking about constant indulgence as if pleasure was something you could have and keep, when we all know it has to come and go, otherwise you don't really feel it. The thing is, our expert culture has then built itself up as the opposite of that indulgence culture. So the experts seem to only care about longevity and productivity. It's a constant scolding that we get, and we all have sort of taken it on. In the book, I say, just as an example of sort of conceptual, you know how when you're walking down the street and you see a police man or woman, mm-hmm. you might even feel happy that they're there. You feel safe. You certainly don't feel, most of us don't feel like we're doing anything wrong and we're going to get in trouble, you know, especially if you're in the ruling race, class, gender, and age. You know, there are specifics for it, but walking down the street, driving in your car, no matter what race, class, gender, and age you are, we all feel like you see a cop, maybe you've done something wrong. And that's because the rules have been set up just outside the standard for driving, partially to make revenue in parking tickets and speeding, but there are other reasons for it. But the point I want to illustrate is we've accepted the charge of feeling a little guilty when we're driving, when we see a cop. And just so, we have accepted the charge of each of us feeling guilty about how we take care of our bodies. There's no way to do all the stuff. I mean, there's no way to do all the flossing and all the meditating. And it's just impossible. So all of us must feel that we are in arrears in different ways. And depending on who you are and where you are and what your natural rhythms and body type is, you can get yourself into a position where you feel terrible. And there's no reason. It's really no reason. Because at the very best, even if the medical and scientific community could tell us what to eat, which it can't, look how it changes every 5 to 10 years. But even if it could, when did we all get together and decide longevity was the absolute criteria for whether something is good or not? If you eat a piece of cake and you feel guilty, you've accepted the idea that longevity is more important than feeling good that day. Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about longevity in the terms that whether you eat a kiwi or an orange is better for you, it really is a little bizarre. When you're talking about it in terms of, you know, really dangerous behaviors, nobody wants to cut a life shorter than the average lifespan. But when you look at a culture like ours, where for millennia, we never had enough food to eat. Every generation in Europe knew famine because local areas grew the same stuff, and when there was a blight, it happened to everybody in the area. And before trains, every generation knew famine. It would happen now and again, and some people would die. And we don't have that anymore. Even though, of course, some people do, we are living in a culture of such abundance that to see that we've turned that around and now are worrying to the same extent we always worried about not getting enough food, that we're now worrying that the food is somehow going to kill us from inside, that it's bad to be well fed. It's heartbreaking when you look and see every culture throughout history has had a vision of heaven as a land of milk and honey, as a food abundance, because food has always been what every animal is after. And to not be at the mercy of anyone else who's trying to eat you, the wolf in the story, the lion in the story. And we're finally in everybody else's vision of heaven, and we've changed the milk to 2%, and we offer sorbitol instead of the honey. And that's just a little sad. It's understandable. I'm not saying that it's bizarre. It's just that it's we're being too rough on ourselves, and I'm absolutely sure that the future will look back at us with some sadness. We'll think these poor people, they exhorted each other to feel badly about themselves to such an extent that it really, the only comparisons you can make is the Egyptians piling up stores for themselves for the afterlife, or the Victorians worrying about sex to the point where marriages were almost sexless, but there was an institution of mistresses because those came from the working class. I mean, these kinds of bizarre things that we look at a society and say, you know, how did they not see that? This was too crazy. And a lot of what we do, I really think, falls into that level of a category. Our divisions between good drugs and bad drugs is also, you know, it's not exactly that I'm telling people to change the way they behave, but I am saying that the way we interpret what we do is really weird. The way that we pretend that the drugs we take today are medicinal and that the drugs that every other period in time, when, you know, throughout most of history, opium and coca, where coca grows, were the drugs that doctors gave out. I mean, that's what doctoring was for a long time. The first opium apothecary opens in the 12th century in Europe and in the 11th century in the Muslim world, because the injunction against alcohol made opium that much more interesting, and it is still the case. That in Muslim worlds they get around the injunction against alcohol by using opium and making it easy to get. So you look at a history where almost every doctor's tincture is made of opium and opiates and low level at times to kill pain or to go to sleep or to just feel better, and then we have drugs that we say they're good drugs if they don't give us bliss. That is, we want productivity and longevity, but in this case, it's so much about productivity. We will take whatever drug will keep you at your desk, and that usually means not being foggy-headed. So because we drive cars and because we use ATM machines, you can't give everybody laudanum because it does make you fuzzy-headed. But the idea that we've convinced each other of, that our drugs are medicine, fixing something broken, and their drugs were inebriation drugs that were masking, that there's no way you could philosophically or scientifically argue that. So we simply don't notice that we're talking, you know, we're talking out of two mouths. We trick ourselves so much, and a lot of the guilt comes from that if we actually said the truth that we say to ourselves and to our friends out loud, then we would all be in a different place, but we don't.
Yeah. Maybe what we should do is take Dr. Phil's famous words and turn them around a little bit and say, you know, ask, how is this working for us? You know?
Right. Yes. That's, I think, that's what the book is about. What is working about it. When I look at a whole culture that all these people in America, we all trade so much of the most valuable thing we have in life, time to be with our loved ones. We trade it for money. We trade whatever we can for money so often, and yet we all repeat the slogan that money can't buy happiness. Well, are we stupid? I don't think so. I think that the rich and the poor alike seek money because there are real things that you can get from money. And the things that we talk about as being cheap and meaningless are sometimes the things that are actually keeping the society together, like shopping, like watching television and sports games. That stuff gives us a middle level of society. Used to be you lived in your country, your town, and that town level had your parish, your extended family. You had a lot of responsibilities in this middle level of society that was a crowd. And then you had your domestic little family of just your nuclear group. We've cut out the middle level. That's what Jefferson was talking about when he said the pursuit of happiness. He's very clear about it when you look closely. And in the book, I cite a little paragraph from letters from Jefferson, from Ben Franklin, and from George Washington to show how clear they were about it, that happiness was about ditching the responsibilities of the middle level and just being with your family and when you have to, you know, going to serve the overall country. And our liberators left us in the lurch. I'm glad I don't have to go to church or temple once a week. It used to be mandatory. People don't really realize that, but so much of the town celebrations and meetings were also mandatory, and extended family was mandatory, all sorts of behaviors. That's what almost all novels were about, right? About somebody who's getting crushed within the rules of town, parish, and extended family. And because of that, we've liberated those rules, ourselves from those rules, and that made us very lonely. We don't have to leave the house, so we stay home, and we all have the TV or the computer, the air conditioning or the heat. And so what used to force us out onto the stoop or to the Elks Club doesn't. And what we have to do is to look around and say, well, what is it that we use to be able to have a conversation with someone who has a different religion than I do, who has a different way of seeing the world in so many different ways? And that's where our shopping and our television and our sports comes in. We may do some of this alone, but it's so much about conversation. It gives us a kind of low-level interaction, and it really does work. And that's why we keep wanting it. Of course, there are people who think that money is going to buy them all of happiness, and they're in for a disappointment. What we found through sociological studies, but also through common sense and through looking at the old fairy tales, is if you're going from an empty pot, real hunger, and a lack of dignity and friends to not poverty and to having a little bit of dignity and friends, you actually do get happy forever after. Sociologists have checked it for 20 years, but the fairy tales told us it was ever after. If you're hungry, it's a burden. And if you don't know where the next meal's coming from, it's a burden. And if you can never pick up the tab, it's a burden. And that leap is huge, from not enough to eat to enough. And after that, money does give you little leaps, but it's a story of diminishing returns. It's never going to be as big as that big first one. And we shouldn't underestimate how important that first leap is out of poverty. But then we need to remember that if you want money to do something good, you have to think about how to use it with some care. And you know, to notice that if you're buying a swimming pool just to keep up with the Joneses, you're not going to be happy. You're going to feel buyer's remorse. You're going to feel regret. But if you're buying a swimming pool because you enjoy the feel of water, that's one of the sort of tried and true things that a certain level of sensual comfort. It seems like water treatments, going to the seaside, that goes right through history. You see it again and again.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Jennifer Michael Hecht. Her latest book is The Happiness Myth, Why What We Think Is Right Is Wrong, A History of What Really Makes Us Happy. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your thoughts, your questions. Questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Tell us a little bit about your invention of the term sour charm.
Here I am writing this book about happiness, and of course I don't want to be the grinning guru because I don't really believe in grinning gurus, and yet I do want to offer what I have. And I started to look around and notice that the writers and thinkers that I most admire never promise a kind of constant happiness. They don't offer that you can do some things and you would be in a whole different place. What they offer is the wisdom to expect a certain amount of disappointment and to see it in the context of a kind of joyful, a joyful context, but to understand that there's disappointment. The almost facial expression of the twinkle in the eye of someone who has seen hard times, who isn't a fool, but who still manages to see the charm in life. I think that if we can just notice that there is this mixed persona, and that when we see it, to remember, you know, this is the sound of someone who is going for happiness and is going to try, but is not going to overstate it to the point where they're tricking people, or they're tricking themselves, worst of all. And so, you know, when I read Freud say that all he's trying to do is give people not happiness but ordinary misery, you know, you smile and you say, gosh, you know, okay, the person's trying to take away pain, but to realize that life itself has a certain amount of ordinary misery in it. I know this may not seem like the most, well, I say in the book, you know, the guru doesn't mention that life is hard no matter what because they risk losing clients. And you know, of course, we can all feel that way, but I feel like it's way more important to be honest about what we can actually accomplish. And giving it a lot of thought has led me to some things which have really helped me to have a little charm in the sour, you know, to see. Well, for one thing, one of the things that runs through the book is the idea of there being three kinds of happiness.
Yeah.
And I think it's so important because when I realized that they're not just different, they contradict each other. So that a good day is usually, good day happiness is forgettable pleasures. It's doing the puzzle when you want to. It's watching TV and drinking a beer or having a fabulous meal or doing the things that that aren't very hard to do and that we know give you pleasure.
And maybe what we could do is come back and talk about the other two in a moment. But I've got a listener who would like to talk with you.
Terrific.
A listener in West Chicago, line 4. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hi.
Happy people. That's what it sounds like, happy people. I sound like my wife. She's very, very positive on everything. No matter how bad it gets, she's always upbeat about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going through a bunch of stuff now, but you were bringing up material and what people, you know, own or don't own. We live in a materialistic world.
Yeah.
And everybody's got to have what everybody else has, which is unfortunate because they forget the values of life in general. If you get an illness, now my family's going through this with cancer, but that aside, even before that, I was always taught, you know, you earn everything, and I take pride in what I do. Nobody's given me anything. I've had to work for everything that I've gotten in my life, and I don't, if I lost it tomorrow, if my house burned down, so be it. Start from scratch as long as I got my health and my well-being. And I find that the younger generation nowadays is more materialistic than I could ever think. The first thing they want to do is, you know, is be like the guy that has all the money, and you know, everything is wrapped around money. And I think it's mixed.
But you're right. Different generations have different tendencies. And with your wife, by the way, I would try being happier than her and see if it makes her do your part. By the way, that remark. I know it sounds like a head game, but sometimes we push someone into being the happy one because we are good at expressing sorrow, and if we take up the happy role, it frees them to experience sorrow a little bit. But that's a little off topic. I think that this question about material it's something that we have to be careful about, because to a certain degree, material goods do us good. I mean, you said that if you lost the house, you'd have to start building it back up, and that's because there are some things that are just plain good. It's good to have a place to call home. You're right. It's young people, especially, who tend to not realize that when you get status-oriented things, they don't change your insides at all. And that's the shocker. And that's why so often it's people who, you know, you often hear that somebody who's in a really high level, someone who's got all the success in the world, is doing drugs to a point that they can't control or actually killing themselves. And why is that? It's because, you know, everybody who's trying to get where they are, you know, to get where the star is, they think they'd be happy if they were only there. So they work hard to get there, and they can keep their head in the game. But the star who actually has everything can't avoid the truth, which is they're still the same person inside. And the only way to deal with that is through, you know, talk therapy and through reading philosophy and reading how other people have managed. You know, it's hard work, or doing meditation. There are ways to deal with how painful certain things are to us that aren't painful to other people. We can make ourselves happier, but it takes work, and it certainly isn't anything that you can buy. But you can recognize that some of these buying activities, you know, if you're in a stable place and you have a life of the mind and you have loved ones and a family and you have a job, you know, it's also okay to enjoy these things that in our culture we're always sort of making fun of as if they have nothing. And they don't have nothing. They, you know, even drinking a beer today, we think of it as entirely, alcohol is a dumbing drug. If you look through history, and I quote some philosophers through in the book of people who, you know, people have talked about both caffeine and alcohol as interesting drugs, as drugs that sometimes can lead you to be able to cry on your friend's shoulder. We see that as sort of like a fake thing, but that's not how everyone's always seen it. So that we all accept the idea that we're being bad when we have a beer, when other cultures see it as a necessary or a desired aspect of certain types of friendships. I go in all directions, but that's because I feel like what I'm trying to share is the notion that that every aspect of our culture is culture, and the parts that are painful, we have a right to look up and say, this isn't what I actually do, it's just what I say I should do. Maybe those two ought to be closer.
The caller there?
Yeah, you know, she brought up some great ideas. Great, you know, I'm going to look forward to reading your book. But
thanks so much.
I'll tell you what, though. I have parents that I have relatives in Europe, and I've been over there for years on end sometimes, and I can appreciate what we have over here.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, because I've been there, done that, let's say. And so I see the other shoe and the other foot. And that's what, you know, we being the greatest country, as far as I'm concerned, in the world, we're spoiled, and people forget our upbringings. And that's where sometimes I even want to get down and write a book about my life experience and tell people this is how people treat each other. And it's gotten down to the point nowadays, everybody, we've got racial divides, we've got this, we've got that. And every day I wake up from, it's hard for me to read the paper,
yeah,
or see the TV or any of that junk.
And I understand, positive. Because you have some sorrow in your life right now, especially. I do talk a lot in the book about there are five sections: wisdom, drugs, money, bodies, and celebration. And in the wisdom section, I break down all of historical wisdom down into four categories, and one of them is to remember death. It sounds depressing, but when you can remember death and when you can understand it and deal with it and really confront it instead of trying to avoid thinking about it, it seems to almost make a post-traumatic bliss. It almost seems to physically change us into being able to appreciate the beauty.
Yeah, it's what we feel when we've had a close call.
Yeah,
yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Terre Haute. Line one, hi.
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 I
I've had, you know, I guess my personal take, you know, I've gone from not being able to pick up the tab and,
right,
and you know, all that. And, well, I've, you know, money can't buy you love, but I did make the leap to, you know, being able to take care of myself eventually, and you know, and you're right, that when you finally do make that leap to being able to take care of yourself and knowing where your next meal is coming from, money does buy you a little bit of happiness there.
Yeah.
You know, or at least security. I don't know if
yeah.
it's happiness.
Well, I think we get our ideas a little mixed up because I think, you know, there's a lot of reasons, but just to say, when you think about philosophers, you imagine that they all say forget money, but they don't. It's really just Jesus and the Buddha. And those two people, thinkers, figures were trying to lead us very much away from this world. And almost every other philosopher, Aristotle, Montaigne, just go through history. You see them saying, Aristotle says, look, money is one of the things that helps a life be, helps a person be able to actualize their life, to be able to grow into the person that they could be. And growing into the person you could be is more important than any of the things that helps you to do it, but money really does help. And again, I'm certainly not campaigning for money. I don't think in America we need anybody to do that. What I am campaigning for is trying to see if we can change the conversation so that we can speak honestly, not just to our friends. You know, we all say, oh, money doesn't buy happiness, and then you whisper to your friends in a giggle, yeah, but give me some, and then I'll see if it's, you know.
Well,
and that's the same thing with so many of our other things. We say, oh, exercise makes you happy, and then you decide, you know what, I want a happy day, and you don't exercise. And how come so much of that is different in the marketplace of ideas than it is between friends or in our own minds? And I think it's a lot of that really is just that we've gotten confused on a couple of things that if you just sort of make some historical clarifications, things start to fall back into a more reasonable balance.
Yeah, I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We're going to go next to another listener, a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just a number of comments. One, I haven't seen your new book, but I have your former book, Doubt, in my other room. It's a great book.
Thank you very much.
But no, a number of comments. If I remember correctly, the Greeks, whatever this means, defined happiness as the pursuit of excellence. But excellence, I have no idea exactly what's meant
mm-hmm.
by that. For example, whenever I receive the copy of the Alum Association, I find it full of comments about excellence, but kind of a glossy, shallow publication. And another comment of one of my intellectual cultural heroes, Ronald Lang. I don't know if you deal with him or not anywhere. He always made the comment that he wasn't a terribly happy person, and I sometimes think happiness is overrated. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Just a number of comments, and
yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. The first one about excellence, you know, in the wisdom section, I try to do what I do in the other sections, which is to try to stand back as an impartial viewer, not a person of our moment, though I am one, and stand back and compare the different periods and see what sticks out about us. And in the wisdom section, what really stuck out was how much we use this kind of motivational conversation. So indeed, the Greeks said that it was about excellence, but it's like it's not all they said. And Shakespeare has some great motivational speeches, but often the motivational speeches are put in the mouth of someone who's already been designated either as a fool or as a king who's too narcissistic, or so that nowadays we rifle through history to look for examples of people who are constantly motivating, and we quote these motivational speeches. Again, of course a good life requires progress and requires that you get to see, to make up some ideas about yourself and then bring them to fruition. But it's just not, throughout history, it just hasn't been as big a deal as it is for us now. We're just we're just crazy with this idea. We're constantly telling each other to buy real estate and diversify our portfolio and add free weights to our workout and don't eat, you know, white wine. Don't drink white wine anymore because red wine has. You know, it's just a really weird period in history in terms of how much motivational stuff goes on. Again, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just got to be seen in the context. That lets you see it. For instance, the actual fact of the treadmill and the fact of the fact that our culture invented the escalator and the stairmaster. Now, that's a paradox. It's silly to think about in a way, but it's also it leads you if you go and do the historical work behind it. What I found was that the periods in time that have been most interested in exercise are periods where there was a ruling class. In the United States, the whole culture was against sports. Protestantism came to America very much against sports because it was one of the things that it was protesting against. Catholicism was full of sports, and the Protestant Reformation was against all sorts of extra stuff that was in the religion other than just the Jesus and the book, you know, the Bible. And so they were against sports to such a degree that it was outlawed all over the place. So America didn't look like it was going to be a sports place. What happened was it was in the South with plantation owners who had slaves and who thought of all physical labor as beneath them. And so they invented these kinds of tournaments, which is exactly what happened in ancient Sparta when they had the slaves, when the slaves outnumbered the Spartans. The Spartans had to spend all their time in physical activity to be able to keep down the slaves, but also to sort of show that they were leisured people. And when I look at the culture now and see that, it really looks like we're doing a number on ourselves. I mean, why would you do an escalator and a stairmaster? The answer is that you want to go to work with clean clothes and come home with clean clothes and to have your sweating separate from your work so that you can remind yourself that you're an indoor worker, you're a desk worker. It's a step up from being out in the field. And I think that it's profound how these subtle ideas really do actually sneak into how we behave. Wouldn't it be easier for a person to work for less money doing a physical job and then not have the money to pay for a gym or the time to pay for a gym, but when they come home from work, they worked out? Well, they don't want that because there's a status issue. So even just doing that kind of thought experiment, you can start to see how sometimes just understanding what we're doing is more important than changing it.
Yeah. In terms of understanding what we're doing, one of the most interesting parts of the book for me was the section on wisdom. Mm-hmm. And here you talk about the four doctrines, apparently, that in the thinking of philosophers, wisdom writers, and self-help leaders, you note that there are four doctrines found in all thinking about happiness.
That's right. They come up over and over.
Yeah, know yourself, control your desires, take what's yours, remember death.
Yeah.
I thought the chapter on know yourself was really fascinating. And maybe before we run out of time, you could talk, and I want to get back to the other two kinds of happiness as well. But one of the things that you said in the interpretation of the directive, know yourself, you say, we live in little cognitive comas.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the ways I sort of help people to understand the extent of it is, and I lead by saying I'm a person with strong political views, but I'm not talking about them right now. I'm talking now about how we think. And one thing I like to say to people is, imagine you took all the babies, it's in the book, if you took all the babies out of the blue bassinets, you know, blue state bassinets, and switched them with all the babies in the red state bassinets right now, in 18 years, would the voting be different? And we know that if you take a baby from China and you raise it here in the United States, you know, you raise it in California, it will have a Valley Girl accent. There's no, there's nothing that isn't culture in those kinds of terms. So if our viewpoints are so obviously dictated or at least strongly influenced by where you grow up, it begins to suggest that we would have managed to find a way to stay in the community of people who we now revile and still manage to find a way to see it as moral. And that goes for both sides. I know it's almost uncomfortable, but that's what I mean by the cognitive coma. I invite everyone to take any issue that you feel is like your most hot-button issue, the thing that makes you so angry that you could barely talk to someone who has the other opinion, and just quietly, in your own mind, see if you can try to convince yourself of the opposite. And what happens is you realize that it's painful to even think about their arguments. And that pain is like an electric fence. It's invisible, and as long as you stay away from it, you think you're free. But we're not exactly free unless you do this very difficult work on yourself of making yourself challenge the things you'd rather not challenge. And not everybody has to do it, but if we want to create a larger center, if we want to believe that this country is not diametrically opposed to its different cultures, somebody's going to have to do this work. We're going to have to start to think about what kind of common ground there is, and the common ground has to come by suggesting some things that seem frightening. You know, none of us want to give ammunition to the other side, but if because of that we bend the truth a little so that we don't even have to risk it, we're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah. We've got to quickly mention the two other kinds of happiness. We mentioned good day happiness,
yeah,
which is a good feeling thing, and then euphoria and a happy life.
That's right. And the euphoria or ecstasy, I just want to mention, is like salt. You really don't need a lot. You can't have a whole meal of it, but you also can't do without.
A little recreational euphoria.
Yeah, I mean, people, you know, there are, I know drugs are illegal, but they are, you can get them, and how come most of the responsible adults you know around you don't use them? Because you don't need a lot of that kind of happiness. In fact, you don't need, you know, you can meet a lot of couples who have sexual euphoria in the beginning of their relationship, and that carries them through periods where they don't have that. Or there are many people who have told me that they, because I write about religious doubt, I talk to a lot of religious people, and I've been told that one experience of a kind of transcendent feeling, you know, back in 1968 at church camp, has managed to keep them in their community, in their faith, and I think ecstasy always works this way, that you don't need that much, but you need some. So if you haven't done it in a while, you don't have to feel bad that you haven't, but if you don't feel like you have any in your life, go get a little. And expect it to be difficult. Know that it's going to be hard, that ecstasy, drug or not, is going to leave you a little bit of a headache the next day. It's all, you know, even if it's dangerous sports, whatever it is, it's hard. And good life, happiness, the best insight I figured out from studying this subject is that good life happiness is not something you get as a prize when you're done with the hard work of birthing and raising and mourning and sweeping and cleaning and all the work and showing up for work every day. It's not a prize you get. It's those efforts seen from a different vantage point in time. Those efforts are the happiness, and you just got to put it in, knowing that it's the happiness itself right there. And if you know that you're a kind of person who tends to go for the kind of happiness that's about happy life, and you don't find yourself happy in any given day, it's time to think about the other two. And if you find yourself mostly seeking, you know, thrills, it's time to think about the other two. And so it's really more about a matter of having a vocabulary to do this kind of thinking.
Okay, there we have to leave it. We're out of time. Jennifer Hecht, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Jennifer Hecht is the author most recently of The Happiness Myth, Why What We Think Is Right Is Wrong, The History of What Really Makes Us Happy. The publisher is Harper San Francisco.